Hello, hello. You are again listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live right now in studio from the UBC Nest, which is located at UBC's Point Grey campus on top of unceded traditional Coast Salish Musqueam territory. For the past few weeks, that is, at 5 p.m., we have been airing CITR Documentary Season 2 episodes. So just some context. If you weren't there a few months ago when this all started making its way out into the world, CITR does documentaries. We've done documentaries for decades now, but over the past 2 years, we've tried to make it something a bit more regular, high impact. Last year, we sort of had a new beginning for the CITR documentary program with the UBC 100 Centennial Series, coincided with the unleashing of a ton of archival content, reel-to-reels, Discorder PDFs, rather, all with the help of UBC Libraries, Digitization Center. All of that content made its way online. And as a result, we also got to hear some really fantastic content, some fantastic documentaries using those archival materials about histories here in the Lower Mainland, which have not quite been brought to light, not been given quite the media representation they deserve at CITR in the guise of student and community-produced documentaries. Just this year, back in May, we debuted CITR Documentaries Season 2. And this time the theme was that of community. And again, on the issues of community here, where we live, play, work, which go underrepresented in the media. So over the past few weeks, if you've been listening to episodes of CITR Documentary Season 2 or have been listening to them online, when you go to Stitcher or iTunes, you can just look up CITR Documentaries to find them. You'll know that we've done topics such as Indigenous food sovereignty, gentrification in Chinatown, Tibetan diaspora, and much more. This week, we're playing two episodes from the CITR Documentaries Season 2 series, which have to do with firebrand topics here on campus. The first is from Cal Murray, and it's called Everything is Alt-Light, or rather, Everything's Alt-Light, to be more correct. And the alt-light is an interesting term. For those of you who are, let's say, up to date with political discourse, the rise of the supposed alt-right is a foreboding thing, especially for, you know, those who identify on the more progressive side of the political spectrum, is a foreboding thing. And certainly with the political ramifications of 2016's presidential election across the border making their way into Canada, it's something that's been popping up and is worth examination. Cal Murray's documentary delves into the, again, maybe I characterized it as such, oblique domain of contemporary free speech movements and what they have to do with this entity that is described as the alt-right. So using unofficial UBC student group, the Free Speech Club, as a case study, this documentary aims to examine and understand what the personal motivations behind modern right-wing discourse lies, who are the people engaged in an ideological war with progressives, peeling back layers of internet irony and anonymity. We hear from victims of online harassment alongside self-confessed trolls and a former white supremacist. So, again, stay tuned. This is from CITR Season 2 Docs from Cal Murray. Everything's alt-light. Please enjoy.
People showed up at Pigeon Park, where there was a new totem pole erected for the survivors of the missing Indigenous and murdered women.
It's December of 2016, and I'm in downtown Vancouver, speaking to a member of anti-fascist network Antifa.
And he felt comfortable to spout hateful shit about, you know, the Indigenous community.
He's wearing a balaclava, and he asks that I don't use his name. And I think the anonymity is because he fears for his safety. He is, after all, here to oppose the presence of Soldiers of Odin, a far-right anti-immigrant street gang. But Soldiers of Odin are only here as muscle, sort of unofficial security for the Christmas party of the Free Speech Club. The Free Speech Club is a group of mostly conservative or libertarian college students who Antifa have identified as alt-right, but the Free Speech Club reject that label and say they're just fighting back against an oppressive campus culture of political correctness.
If you ever talk about Trump in a positive light, or any conservative view in a positive light on campus, people are gonna ostracize you. People will think you're some kind of a racist, misogynist, whatever label they have for you, and they want to keep you from talking, right? So that's what, it's kind of like a protest against that. It's a protest against the political correctness culture.
Neo-Nazis have this new manifestation in the alt-right, where they're just all clean-shaven college kids who just want to have a conversation. It doesn't make it any better.
Come drink and talk with us. Why are you standing out here?
Have a conversation.
Have a conversation.
Have a dialogue.
We're not actually white supremacists, you know.
Free speech is simply a moniker for them to say, I want to say shitty things and get away with it and normalize it.
So Antifa were pretty certain that what they were dealing with in the Free Speech Club was an alt-right group, and that's a perfectly justifiable conclusion, especially considering their allies on that particular night. But I wasn't really as satisfied with the alt-right moniker, given how liberally that term is tossed around in the wake of the Trump election. And so I felt I should dig a bit deeper to find out if the Free Speech Club really were alt-right, and what alt-right even meant, to meet the people involved, to find the ideology that underpinned it, and to discover what made these people feel so isolated and alienated on campus. I'm Cal Wiseman-Murray, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, being broadcast from unceded Musqueam territory, and today I'm asking, what exactly is the alt-right? So I thought I should start with the person who had created all that chaos just from hosting a Christmas party. So I went looking for the Free Speech Club, and I tracked down their founder.
One, I'm a person of color, Louis Jung. I'm bisexual, 23. And I grew up around poverty. I study visual arts in UBC Vancouver. Yes, I started the Free Speech Club, and it's one of the best things that I've ever done. It's amazing.
Well, the UBC Free Speech Club is, just as the name says, it's a club that focuses on the issues of free speech in Canada, especially in university campuses. We started this year, and we quickly became the most notorious and the most hated, most vilified group in UBC, and everyone loves to hate us. For example, a few days ago, we put up posters. And we have spies in the UBC feminism groups, and they were coordinating and organizing to take down the posters.
You've got spies though?
Yeah.
So we never used to decline people specifically for affiliation with the Free Speech Club, because that is silly, and being in that club does not necessarily make you anti-feminist. I'm Afi. I am a UBC student. I also admin and moderate the UBC Needs Feminism page, and I work within the local nonprofit feminism kind of environment. We ended up having some people who would screenshot our members' comments or posts and then post it to Free Speech Club, and essentially like berate and make fun of them, like personal attacks. Me, I don't particularly care if they're going to make fun of me behind my back. Like, it's vaguely annoying, but no more annoying than a mosquito. But I understand that it's really distressing to some of our members, and I guess making sure our members don't feel unsafe in the group is more important than letting in free speech members.
People who disagree with me and people who disagree with what my club stands for always calls me a troll. Always calls us a troll, and they think, oh, we're a big troll group on campus. And in a sense, they're kind of right. We are pretty trolly.
For some quick context on where the Free Speech Club actually sit politically, I will say that Lewis's fiancée, Theron Meyer, who is also involved with the club, has written for Breitbart that Lewis himself is organising Q&A events with controversial U of T professor Jordan Peterson, and that the club made a point of wearing Make America Great Again hats on campus.
Trolling engages the layman. It awakens the dormant, the people who are apolitical and dormant, because they even because if enough people get triggered and offended by it, and it starts to affect the people who have been dormant, and they start to think about it. You know what I mean? And people who get to engage the layman and who can get the layman on their side kind of wins the culture war.
Lewis was openly telling me that the Free Speech Club are fighting a culture war, that they see progressives and liberals as the dominant authoritarian force to be rebelled against. Personally, I find it hard to frame trolls as valiant underdog rebels when the rebellion amounts to little more than bullying or harassment, but it's complex and the balance of power online is always in flux. To get a better understanding of this culture war, I spoke with Angela Nagel, journalist and author of Kill All Normies, From 4chan to Donald Trump and the Alt-Right.
I think there's a mixture of people in there. I mean, I think there are genuinely some people who do feel that that speech is being stifled in universities and so on. There are others, of course, who are just opportunists and who will change their mind as soon as, you know, they find themselves in a position of power. I mean, historically, the right has been appalling on free speech issues.
Just a quick apology about the sound here. We had some difficulties recording via Skype, but we've done our best to make it listenable.
So, you know, I think that people who suspect that this is all, just an excuse for them to say whatever they want, I think they're right. There's two big problems. One is that the people who are defending free speech from that kind of right-wing position are not making any distinction between what you ought to be allowed to say, as in you shouldn't suffer sanctions from the state for saying, and then what you ought to say or you ought not to say on the grounds of all kinds of things, basic empathy, sort of manners. You know,
one of the big fights that has gone on around the alt-right is sort of about the definition. So, originally kind of everything was being called alt-right, from Trump all the way over to sort of neo-Nazis. And then, like, a group within that set were inclined to kind of say that they were the real alt-right, if you like, or the people who sort of came up with the name and therefore it sort of described them best. Well,
what Angela's saying is that it's a mistake to lump groups like the Free Speech Club in with the rest of the alt-right, and that we need to be a bit more careful with that distinction.
So I would consider that much broader group to be quite different. The ones that are primarily concerned with freedom of speech, you know, but also maybe would be critics of mass immigration, the kind of people I would associate with Milo Yiannopoulos, Gavin McInnes, and so on. I think that they are different. So I don't think that their central concern is necessarily race at all.
I felt like talking to Angela had helped me get to grips with the terminology. Alt-light seemed like a much better fit for the Free Speech Club than alt-right, because it removed the implication that Lewis, a Korean man, could even be a white supremacist. But I wondered if white supremacists would draw that same line and how they felt about their more moderate allies or counterparts. I caught up with Tony McAleer, former neo-Nazi and organiser for the White Aryan Resistance, in his local pub.
At the age of 20, I thought I'd be dead or in jail by the age of 30 as a white revolutionary. I stockpiled assault weapons and ammunition and did paramilitary training in the woods. I joined the Canadian military to get training. I was on the Montel Williams show twice. In 1989, I was dressed like a skinhead. In 1991, I was wearing a suit and tie and had grown my hair out. It was in order to, you know, my gift was always to make the unreasonable sound reasonable, but you have to look reasonable as well. And it was purely to make the message more accessible to people. Towards the end of the 90s, and it's funny watching the alt-right emerge today and people like Richard Spencer, we said, don't get tattoos. That's how they can identify you. You know, put on a suit, dress better, go to college, grow your hair out, go mainstream.
I asked Tony why far-right groups like Sons of Odin would try to partner with or recruit from the Free Speech Club.
The darker, more extreme side of that movement will use and exploit anything it can possibly can. That's what I would have done. That's what I did do. But you know, there's a full spectrum of beliefs. It's, you know, it's not just race. You get into the whole fiscal side of things and the Federal Reserve, and there's a whole spectrum of issues, and people have different ones that suit their fancy. And you know, even amongst Trump supporters, there's people that voted for Trump that can't stand Trump, but they voted because they wanted the Supreme Court seat. You want to be careful in boxing everyone into, you know, different labels, but those that can be used and exploited absolutely will be used and exploited. But to understand that, you know, anything past the center point is right. Right? And you want to be careful that not to take everything right of center and throw it on to a label, because those labels and the shaming of people entrenches them further. The violence and violence protests against them entrenches them further. And you know, the scary thing that I see in the United States in the way things are moving now is there is no middle. The middle's evaporated. There's no compassion whatsoever. You've got two sides completely dehumanizing each other. The problem isn't the right, the problem isn't the left. The problem is dehumanization. And if the left wants to utilize the strategy of dehumanizing the right, you're going to empower the right. You're going to feed the right. There's nothing, those trolls, and there's nothing I like more than having people come at me, be derogatory or threatened with violence. We fed off of that. So you want to be careful you're not feeding the beast that you're trying to destroy.
I was still cautious about the consequences of humanizing someone like Lewis, worried that it might normalize hateful and often disingenuous rhetoric. But Tony seemed to understand this world better than anyone I'd spoken to, so I decided to take his advice, and I sat down again with Lewis, this time intentionally leaving politics to one side.
Well, I was born in Korea, but I mostly grew up in the Philippines. I went to the Philippines when I was about 10 years old, and I left the Philippines when I was about 19 years old. So I grew up there. I went to elementary school, middle school, and high school there. My parents basically ran a small business in the Philippines and kept us going. It was pretty good, yeah. The reason why I speak English so well is because they ran an English academy, and I pretty much grew up in the business, and I pretty much learned English from my parents' employees. Oh, well, it's childhood memory, so it's kind of like glorified, right? So, you know, it was nice, warm, very dangerous. I remember it was very, very dangerous growing up there. I remember someone was killed outside of my house. His torso was cut in half and there was blood everywhere. The body was taken out before I was able to see it. It's a good thing I only saw the puddle of blood that was left over. One of the most dangerous avenues in the whole world is called Quezon Avenue, and it's called the Death Road because it has the highest rates of deaths, and there will be dead bodies on it maybe every month, sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly. But I was very lucky to avoid the brunt of it. I kind of became almost sedated to it. Like, to me, when I see physical violence, I wouldn't feel anything. And it only when I came to Canada and I started therapy, like, I kind of broke apart and I became sensitive again. I was able to resensitize myself, and I grew a sense of empathy if you had empathy while growing up in the Philippines, it takes a toll on you, and you kind of learn to block out that feeling. Physical violence, it was the modus operandi, and I do not want to see that culture in Canada or in Korea, where problems are not solved through words but through violence. I don't want to see that here.
So that was Lewis, and while it was hard to disagree with his concerns about violence, I couldn't quite square those concerns with his blasé attitude towards trolling and causing upset. Nonetheless, I'd grown to quite like Lewis. He's funny, he's engaging, and he can be genuinely warm and welcoming. And I wondered, perhaps patronizingly, if the young men of the alt-light and alt-right would eventually tire of trolling and move on to other pursuits, and hoped, maybe naively, that it was a passing fad, an inexplicable thing that we were obsessed with for a brief moment. As for Tony, I'll leave you with his story of how he left the neo-Nazi movement.
At 23, I found myself in the delivery room holding this beautiful little baby girl, and you know, she has this little scrunchy face, and she opens her eyes, and I know that my face is the first picture that her brain's going to take. I'm now responsible for this other human being. You know, the beautiful thing about children is, in order to be in that state, in order to be that internet troll, in order to be in that place of that ideology that you're talking about, well, one generally has to be disconnected. I was completely disconnected from my, I was a bright, sensitive kid growing up in a household where it wasn't safe to be sensitive. I learned early on to shut my feelings down, and as I got into the skinhead thing and got into the violence, I was never a tough kid growing up, but my bullying survival strategy was befriend the bully, become the bully. You know, there's, when I talk about violence, who one has to become in order to do violence is not something I would wish on anyone. I chose to go there, right? There was no, I don't ever blame anything on my childhood. Everything I did, I chose to do. But human beings don't do anything without a payoff. And what I got was acceptance, approval, attention. I got safety, a sense of power, notoriety. You know, the ability to instill fear in other people, to me, was a distorted sense of power. But it was intoxicating. The adrenaline rush was intoxicating. And I'll be honest, when I started doing it, I liked it.
Tony is now Executive Director of Life After Hate, a non-profit which helps individuals de-radicalise and leave extremist groups. For more information, visit lifeafterhate.org. This documentary was written and produced by me, Cal Wiseman-Murray, with production assistance from Billy Sampson and Jonathan Q. Thanks to Malone Mullen, thanks to Eleanor, John and everyone at CITR. For more on this series of short documentaries, visit citr.ca.
Hello, once again, if you've just tuned in, this is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the unceded Coast Salish territory, the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. You just heard Cal Murray's Everything's Alt Light. It aired first as part of CITR Documentaries Season 2. You can find out more by going to citr.ca/docs, or you can listen to an archival podcast of that episode by going to Stitcher or iTunes, just look up CITR Docs on either of those services. If you're interested in learning more about the topics that Kyle dived into, Andrea Nagel's book, Kill All Normies, is out now. So definitely think about checking that out. Check out some of the responses it's garnered online. Join the conversation if you are keen. This next documentary comes courtesy of Sydney Soldan. It's another piece from CITR Documentary Season 2, which, as I have said before, for Cal's documentary, you can find all the episodes online right now if you go to Stitcher or iTunes or citr.ca/docs, or you can continue tuning in right now. It's called Activists of Academia, and it's sort of a spiritual successor to a documentary which we had from Eleanor Waring as a part of last year's UBC 100 Docs. Waring's documentary, Waiting for Godiva, was about an unresolved legacy of sexual assault culture on campus, around which sparks of discussion would materialize but never fully cement. With student leadership and others at levels of power within the university institution remaining evasive. That documentary won an honorable mention from the documentary category of the National Canadian Campus and Community Radio Conference. Definitely be sure to check it out. It's on citr.ca/docs, or again, Stitcher, iTunes, look up CITR Docs. Sydney Soldan's documentary, which you're about to hear, Activists of Academia, asks a similar question. When examining over the past decade or so the upswells of feminist activism on campus in reaction to violence and abuse on campus versus the seeming inconsistency of activism on campus, what is there to be gained from this? What lessons are there to take into the future? So without further ado, here is Sydney Soldan's Activists of Academia.
Universities have always been known to be a hotspot for protest among students. From the anti-Vietnam War movement to the recent tuition protests on campuses across North America and countless others, students know that in order to make a change, they need to make their voices heard. UBC has also seen its fair share of activism in its century-long history. However, its relationship is pretty fickle. In 2013, six stranger-in-the-dark sexual assaults occurred on campus over the span of just a couple months. There is an inescapable feeling of unease on campus. Students felt unsafe and unprotected at their own university, and in response, feminist activist groups fought back. 3 years later, in 2016, UBC saw yet another spike of violent sexual assaults. But unlike in 2013, activism was much quieter. What happened? Was there actually less activism taking place, or was it just more hidden from the public eye than it had been in the past? There is clearly a cycle of rape culture at UBC that is yet to be broken, and activism can be a powerful tool in changing this. How have students at UBC affected change throughout the years with their activism, and how does the university respond to the demands of its students? My name is Sydney Soldan, and these are the Activists of Academia. In the fall of 2013, two marches were held on campus by feminist groups with the intention to respond to the fears of the student community and to get a message across to university administration. The first march was Take Back the Night, part of a series of events held by communities all over the world. This one stirred up some controversy, but we'll get back to that later. The March to Reclaim Consent was the second march on campus in the fall of 2013. Organized entirely by students. Laura Fukumoto was one of the organizers of this event. She speaks about the atmosphere on campus prior to the attacks.
So it was the fall of 2013. It was my final semester at UBC. And first of all, right at the beginning of the year, Sauter had been sort of nationally exposed.
Right.
For rape chants, somebody had like posted something to Twitter, and then something similar had happened at a university in Nova Scotia. So the CBC and Global News, they all sort of like jumped on this story. And on campus, everyone was sort of responding to that at first. And then very shortly after all of that media storm, there was a stranger in the dark sexual assault on campus. And very close after that, at one point in mid-October, it felt like once every weekend, we were hearing reports from the university. And right at this exact same time, a pretty thick fog had rolled through campus and stayed for like 2 weeks solid. So you couldn't see anybody 10 feet away. It was such an odd atmosphere because campus was so creepy and everyone was on edge. And for me personally, this, like the topic of sexual assault on campus, feminism, discussing like body issues, body positivity, that was something that I had sort of low-key done throughout my degree. Suddenly, literally everybody was talking about what is it like to be a woman on campus. And this is something that I, like a lot of us, you know, a smaller group of us have been talking about for our entire lives, it felt like.
Those sodder rape chants that Laura mentioned are just one of many indicators that rape culture still exists on campus and has for a very long time. Laura told me more about this history.
In my experience doing the March to Reclaim Consent and participating in Take Back the Night, I heard other people speak who had were alumni of UBC, and they said, in my day, in 1970, whatever, like there was a series of sexual assaults that happened just like this, and the UBC covered it, and there was discussion, and they told us not to walk alone at night. This person's mother had also gone to UBC. This person's grandmother had also gone to UBC, and there were always stories. Like, as a person who moved here, the first thing that was told to me was, don't walk alone in forests on this campus. Have this long history. And nobody knows that really coming here. We only know that from what we tell each other secretly, like what we tell each other, right? Or thank God that somebody's like, we have the internet now to like listen and broadcast, because women have been speaking the whole time. Just nobody's been listening.
Noticing a pattern? This fickle relationship with activism that I alluded to earlier seems to be most prominent in the wake of a tragic or controversial event. And then things quiet down and activism stays out of the spotlight for a couple years until the next attack or controversy. The cycle just keeps repeating itself over and over again, and the root of the problem is never actually solved. Alex Murky was another student who was not shy about voicing her opinion. During her undergrad as a political science major, she co-founded the Talon, UBC's left-wing activist alternative to other, more traditional UBC press. She recalls her experience while getting involved with activism at UBC and explained more to me about this cycle.
I thought about this a lot when I was on campus because, I mean, I hadn't really heard anything about the history of campus activism until I got involved in like local politics, and I ended up meeting some people who had been involved at UBC, and I found out that they did all this really interesting stuff that I had never heard about. And so I think it's super easy to go through your 4 years or however many years at UBC and just think that there's just no activism going on whatsoever. And that there never has been, because for whatever reason, there's not really a culture of people thinking about the campus in that way.
So what exactly does UBC's activist culture look like? And are most students even aware that this culture exists on their campus?
Like, in terms of activism on campus, UBC kind of tends to go through periods of intense activism and then sort of lulls where there's no one really organizing, or that's not fair. I mean, like, there will be groups organizing, but in some cases there isn't, like, a very active or visible, like, activist presence on campus. So I would say that before the attacks and the marches, we were probably in one of those lulls at UBC where most people wouldn't have been super aware of the types of things that organizing groups are trying to do. There wasn't that much outreach, so there's sort of a disjointed atmosphere, although simultaneously, I'm Indy Keith, who I referred you to. She had run this event, I think, the previous year called UBC News Feminism. It was part of this broader series of, like, photo events on campuses where people would take pictures with a sign that said, I need feminism because of, or UBC needs feminism because of X. So she had run that, and then after that, she started a Facebook group to sort of, like, keep the momentum going. And I was part of that, and that was kind of, I mean, the first experience I had with feminism on campus was participating in this Facebook group that actually got quite big and popular. But I think a lot of us also heard about the attacks, like, when they happened through that Facebook group. It was sort of, it became sort of a space where a lot of people were communicating about politics, especially people, I mean, people at very different stages in their political development as well. But yeah, so I think in general, I would describe the, like, sort of activist climate before the marches and the attacks as fragmented and not really pulling in that much attention.
As Alex mentioned, UBC Needs Feminism was another feminist group that gained a lot of popularity in the wake of the 2013 attacks. This Facebook group provided a safe space for people to discuss issues online that weren't openly being discussed on campus. Like Alex, it also exposed many students to activism for the first time. Indy Keith was the organizer of this group. She talks about how she became involved and how this community developed into something so influential.
It started out as an event. I believe we hosted spring of my freshman year at UBC in 2013. And after our page sort of blew up, I think we got on the front page of the Men's Rights Reddit for a time, which made things really interesting in the run-up to the event. But the sort of community developed there, and it was something that I could tell people had been maybe looking for a place for that kind of conversation and weren't finding it, at least at UBC. And so I decided to just sort of roll the comment section of the event into a Facebook group. Didn't really anticipate that it would get as big as it did, but that was sort of how the whole thing started and how it became what it is now.
We want freedom, we want rights, we are taking back the night.
As mentioned earlier, there was another event that contributed to the cycle of feminist activism on campus. Take Back the Night is a nonprofit organization that holds events worldwide, including one that occurred at UBC on October 30th, 2013. Here, students voiced their dissatisfaction with the university's response to the attacks that did not really address the root of the problem that is rape culture on campus. Speaking with activists that attended the event, it seems as though there were mixed feelings towards it. Although the message behind Take Back the Night had good intentions, some attendees felt as though issues concerning intersectionality were not properly addressed, which caused some controversy during the event. Laura gave me her perspective on the event.
Okay, the Take Back the Night march. Ideologically, I think there were some differences. So, I mean, for me, my understanding of Take Back the Night as a march, as a rallying point, that those words, that phrase, is largely centered around women being able to move freely in the night without being blamed for what other people perpetrate against them. But I believe their hearts were in the right place. I think that if we had sat down and talked more about, like, our beliefs about, like, what feminism is and where it's headed, we would have a lot to disagree about. It's just, like, sort of, I'd heard it repeated, and it was well understood that they, as an organization, are not trans inclusive. Somebody responded, I don't know who, but we were all standing around, and it was, like, really dark and really rainy. And somebody said, go get your own march. And so at that point, I was like, this is messy. And so a lot of people left after that point because of that. And it put a really bad taste in my mouth. And that is not the kind of space that I wanted to create. It became apparent at that point that, like, there needed to be something else as well as that, especially because there doesn't just need to be, like, one moment.
As Laura said, this is an ongoing conversation that we can learn and grow from, not just one event here and there. The challenges brought up at Take Back the Night helped shape other feminist groups, UBC Needs Feminism and the March to Reclaim Consent included. I spoke more with Indy about how this happened.
I personally wasn't involved with Take Back the Night, and I know there was some criticism of that event because, I mean, the national and international sort of umbrella of Take Back the Night has had some issues with racism and transphobia and just sort of being very white feminist-y in many places. It's definitely not true for every such event, but there had been some issues and like a history of exclusion at those events that some folks were uncomfortable with. And I think a lot of the impetus for creating the March to Reclaim Consent was to sort of address those intersectionality concerns that many people had with Take Back the Night, and also to make something that specifically addressed the context of UBC and the recent attacks that had happened, and also the fact that our activism and our marches were taking place in a very specific place, which is on unceded territory. And a lot of the dialogue that happened in the Facebook group sort of created the ideas and principles and motivations that shaped the March to Reclaim Consent more than Take Back the Night, which is a larger but less, I think, intentionally shaped event. It was just sort of a direct response to the attacks and the fear and anger a lot of people were having.
While many groups have been created and many protests have been held throughout UBC's history, there seems to be a problem with longevity. Perhaps it's the lack of resources UBC gives these groups, or perhaps it's just the general disinterest that seems to pervade the student body. Whatever the reason, it has created a cycle that is difficult to break. In 2016, another string of sexual assaults occurred on UBC's campus, repeating history yet again. The same fears and angers were brought up, but nothing has changed. And as Laura said earlier, alumni of UBC dealt with the same problems generations ago. So what does all of this mean for the future of campus activism at UBC?
I think part of what is keeping this in like the cycle is a lot of the biggest and most impactful student activist movements have never been institutionalized. So we've got this very large group in UBC Needs Feminism, but it's not officially attached to the university in any way. We don't receive funding. We don't have a meeting space that's for us. We don't have necessarily the resources that an official club might. And if you don't have that official institutionalized structure for handing over control and keeping the ball rolling, sometimes you can just lose that momentum. It can be really difficult to sustain that momentum when there's no buy-in from the people who actually have the power to change it. I mean, I don't know that we can say that no department or no representative of the university is helping. On the whole, the institution is not doing its due diligence when it comes to protecting and serving the marginalized people that feminist activist groups and communities are rising up to protect. I don't think there's many universities that are. I think as both an institution and a student community, my experience was that UBC had a very small core group of people who cared a lot and did a lot and really tried to push the administration and push their peers to do better. But I think more than anything, what I saw on an institutional level and from a large portion of the student body was apathy and just believing, you know, if it wasn't the worst there was, then it wasn't worth doing anything about. So I think the university could absolutely be doing more.
But all hope is not lost, and there are signs that UBC is taking a step in the right direction. For instance, Ashley Bentley was promoted to a new role as Sexual Assault Intervention and Prevention Advisor. And as of April 13th, 2017, UBC approved its first standalone sexual assault policy, which will hopefully eliminate unnecessary delays in reporting assaults and bring more cases to justice. But there is still a long way to go. The 2017 AMS presidential election reiterates the general lack of knowledge on UBC's sexual assault policy and the way administration addressed multiple instances of sexual misconduct by a PhD student in the history department shows that sexual assault is still frequently covered up by the university. We are headed in the right direction, but more needs to change. As cliche as it is, everyone can make a difference. Despite the challenges it is sometimes faced with, activism does and has made a difference. And these student activists are living proof that students have a lot more power to create change than they may think.
Hello again. If you are tuned in now, this is CITR 101.9 FM broadcasting live from UBC Point Grey on top of unceded traditional Coast Salish Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam territory. We just heard Sydney Soldan's Activists of Academia. It's a part of CITR Doc Season 2. You've been tuned in for the hour. You also heard Cal Murray's Everything's Alt Light. Both are available for re-listening along with every other documentary that we've released in the past 2 years at citr.ca/docs, or if your preferred platform is Stitcher or iTunes, just look up CITR Docs there to find our documentaries for free download. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to Sydney Soldan and Cal Murray for those fantastic pieces. Thank you to CRTC Radio Meters for partial funding of this project. And tune in next week again, and this time if you'd like to hear more documentaries straight from the airwaves. Coming up next, Radio Pizza Party here on CITR 101.9 FM.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite. Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
The hardcore stuff is just is fast, very aggressive and loud, you know, music, angry music.
I'm your host, Mr. Steeston Mike. Welcome to the Flex Your Head Show on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. I'm here every Tuesday,
6 to 8 p.m.
Playing some punk and hardcore for you. If you want to hear something, feel free to give me a call at 604-822-2487 or swing by flexyourhead.net and send us an email with a request.
Flex Your Head!
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the Food Bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
On August 15th, Canadians celebrate Acadia with a show like none other in Canada's capital. Grab your instruments and head over to Parliament Hill for 6 p.m. to take part in a huge tintamarre for National Acadian Day. At 8:30 p.m., it's showtime at Jacques Cartier Park in Gatineau at the incredible Mosaic Canada site. Roach Voisin, Kevin Parent, Patsy Gallant, Joey Robin Haché, Lulu Hughes, and many more will be on hand to entertain you. Admission is free for everyone. For details, go to canada15aout.ca.
Treasons and Treasons Radio. This is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you are now rocking with the best, 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Rails, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, all right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
Make some noise for Tristan Wheeler.